What Women Must Know with Sheryl Selman, Mondays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show about holistic perspectives and solutions for women's health matters. I'm your host, Dr. Sheryl Selman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, author, radio host, as you know, but I have another show on this same network every Sunday at 4 p.m. called The Women's Healing Circle, and that is a call-in show, and I'm a passionate women's health advocate. It's great having you join us today for another exploration and in-depth conversation into subjects that women must know, and of course, men must know these things as well, so everyone is invited to listen in. I also wanted to make sure everyone knows I have a great website, whatwomenmustknow.com. If you opt in there, you'll get special reports. I have a new special report coming out very soon, and I have many free articles that have been published in different publications, so they're available on my articles page, and some tele-seminar classes. It's all there for free because it's a chance to just get the kind of knowledge that's going to help you make informed choices. And that's really one of my prime directives in life, is empowering people with truthful information so then you can make the best choice possible for your health and well-being. I also want to remind everybody that my new book, The Promise of HCG, How to Banish Fat, Resculpt Your Body, and Rebalance Your Metabolism, is out, hot off the press, and you can order it on my website. There's a special offer, free shipping, discount on books, and if you're looking for a new paradigm that finally gets the results and really rebalances the brain to support the initiation of fat burning and reduction of cravings and improve sleep and moods, everything which is necessary to really restore proper metabolism in the body, then that's the book you want to read. It changed my life, and it's changed the lives of about 600 people I've worked with so far. So check it out. It's there for you to have a look at. Okay, you know, many years ago, actually not so many years ago, after I wrote my first book, Hormone Heresy, I, of course, continued to delve into the issue of women's health topics, and it led me to research a book that became my second book, which is called What Women Must Know to Protect Their Daughters from Breast Cancer. And I wrote that book because as I was lecturing around the world, I was actually quite shocked and horrified to discover that I was meeting younger women, younger women, I'm talking about women in their 30s or 20s that were being diagnosed with breast cancer, which I found really shocking. I mean, breast cancer wasn't ever supposed to be found in that population of women. I also was encountering more and more mothers and parents who were having children with precocious puberty, which right now the statistics are 1 out of 6 8-year-olds are going into puberty. So there were a number of factors occurring through the people I was meeting and the research that made me really concerned about what is happening to our children and the risks that they are exposed to and the potential of what can happen to their health down the track. So I've been following the impact of environmental toxins and hormone disruptors for a long, long time and have been quite alarmed and, of course, very much aware that they are playing a role in this growing incidence of hormonal imbalances and illnesses and things such as breast cancer that are occurring more and more, especially in populations that were never, ever diagnosed. So it caught my attention about a month ago or so when I got an email from a group that I subscribe to called the Breast Cancer Fund. And it's a wonderful organization. We'll be talking more about it. And they posted a an email talking about a recent study that showed the impact of a very ubiquitous chemical in all our foods and packaging called bisphenol A. And I was so impressed with what, and shocked, I have to say, at what this study revealed, that I invited the two people who are involved with the Breast Cancer Fund and the research to be my guest today. So I'm thrilled. They are both here with me. We have Connie Engel, Dr. Connie Engel, who is program coordinator at the Breast Cancer Fund and is an expert on the conjunction of science and advocacy in the environmental breast cancer movement. Her extensive study of social movement, social change, and health psychology provide a cross-disciplinary lens to the Breast Cancer Fund's science-based advocacy efforts. Her work focuses on efforts to translate the science into public education and market and policy-based change. And we also have Dr. Janet Gray, who is a professor of psychology and particularly focusing on neuroscience and director of the program in science, technology, and society at Vassar College. She received her BA in psychology from Simmons College and her PhD in behavioral neuroscience from the University of Massachusetts. And for 25 years, her primary laboratory research focused on neural and peripheral metabolic mechanisms by which estrogens and mixed anti-estrogens, especially tamoxifen, affect eating, body weight regulation, and metabolic activity. In the past few years, Dr. Gray has been interested in learning and teaching about the intersection of environmental and women's health issues, focusing on environmental risks and breast cancer. She has turned her research and writing focus towards engaging in the public conversation on these complex issues. She is the director of the Vassar College Environmental Risks and Breast Cancer Project, a team effort that has led to the production of bilingual, interactive, user-friendly CDN website, and the author of the Breast Cancer Fund's State of the Evidence, the Connection Between Breast Cancer and Environment, as well as several related journal articles. So we have with us today two extremely influential, prominent people in the world exploring the relationship of breast cancer and environmental toxins. So we just are so privileged and delighted to have both Dr. Connie Engel and Dr. Janet Gray with us today. So hello to both of you.
Hi, Cheryl. Thank you so much for having us.
Hi there.
Well, thank you so much for creating the time to be with me. As you can see, I'm really passionate about this subject that we're going to be talking about. And I'm just so grateful to both of you for your commitment and dedication to getting this important information out into the world. You know, it's like we it's like we're fighting a predominant paradigm that is often a challenge to confront, and seems that you're doing a really good job at doing that.
Well, thank you. We're both very honored to be working with the Breast Cancer Fund, but also a coalition of scientists, physicians, researchers, advocates, community people, all of whom are trying to make a change in the world.
You know, this has nothing to do with the topic, Janet, but I have to say, can't help myself, my brother was the first male class to graduate from Vassar College. So I just had to put
excellent.
That in there.
Excellent. And that was many, many years ago.
I guess it was more than he'd like to remember.
I won't say how many, but let's just say a lot.
Well, he was in that groundbreaking class.
Right.
So why don't we talk about maybe we can talk a little bit about how each of you first entered into this world of looking at the science-based evidence connecting chronic diseases and hormone-disrupting chemicals and conditions like breast cancer. You know, what got you passionate about this whole area?
So this is Connie, and I was a graduate student at Arizona State University starting my PhD program, which was in an interdisciplinary social science program called Justice and Social Inquiry. So people looked at science and technology issues, women's issues, you know, a whole range of different kinds of questions, and really brought kind of a what's the problem and how can we look to multiple disciplines to come up with solutions. And I was taking an environmental justice class, and I thought, oh, I'd love to look at environmental links to breast cancer. This was about 2002. And I started doing some research, both at the library but also on the web, thinking, well, if I were facing a diagnosis of breast cancer, what would I do to find out, you know, if there were environmental concerns that I should know might have, you know, been part of my having the disease. So I looked at some of the mainstream breast cancer and cancer organizations and looked at how they talked about environmental links and was surprised to see that they were basically saying there wasn't a lot of evidence to support a link. And I was really, frankly, very surprised by that because I had walked into it assuming that there was quite an accepted link. So I stepped back and, you know, Google led me to some organizations who were really at the cutting edge of looking at those links, one of them being, of course, the Breast Cancer Fund, who had months before perhaps put out the first edition of State of the Evidence, which was absolutely an astonishing document in my research at that point. And given the different messages, I was like, there's absolutely a story here, and I was hooked. I wanted to keep reading and talk to everybody I could.
And you are.
And she is. So you covered a lot of my background as Janet in your very kind introduction. I'm trained as a neuroscientist, and I'm a lab scientist, and I teach neuroscience as my main area here at Vassar. And my research field has been looking at estrogens and estrogen mimics or antagonists, including the drug tamoxifen and its effect on brain. And about 10 years ago, because my research was on tamoxifen, I was reading the breast cancer literature. As I'm sure you know, tamoxifen's the major adjuvant treatment for breast cancer. So I was reading the breast cancer literature and the concerns about endocrine disrupting compounds were really beginning to grow, and it was a very controversial literature, but just a fascinating one. And I realized as I was reading more and more about environmental estrogens and breast cancer, while it certainly applied to my work as a neuroscientist, getting into that field and becoming a part of the public conversation was a way that I could pull together my interests as a scientist, my background in particular in estrogen and physiology, and my long-term devotion to both environmental and women's health issues. So it was, for me, as I went through sort of a midlife intellectual crisis, needed to do something. I had been doing lab research for 25 years, needed to find something that just absolutely energized me, and this was it, and my life's been transformed.
Nice to find your passion, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And purpose. Can I, before we talk about environmental hormone disruptors and chemicals, I do have to ask you about your research with tamoxifen. I actually have written a major article about tamoxifen, but I'd like to hear what you found or what your research was investigating.
Well, so I was looking at tamoxifen effects in a rodent model in rats. So I want to be very careful that this was not clinical studies, but I was interested in early on looking to see whether or not there were models that were relevant in the brain that were similar to models that were being studied in breast tissue. Most endocrinologists didn't think of brain as being a target tissue for hormones for a long time. And so we showed that there were, in addition to estrogen receptors, there were anti-estrogen receptors similar to what had been shown in breast tissue in areas of the brain that are known to be important in regulating metabolic function and reproductive behaviors and physiology. And some of the last work I did was looking again in rodent brain systems showing changes in ATP levels that were dose-dependent and time-dependent. A controversial study, actually, but one that I now understand because we were getting our major effects with very low doses, and the reviewers didn't like that. But as we'll talk about, as we start talking about endocrine disruptors, it all makes loads and loads of sense. So you
were seeing a connection with the drug tamoxifen affecting receptors in the brain that had to do with metabolic functions,
Mainly trying to characterize the tamoxifen interaction with estrogen receptors in specific brain areas, and then showing that in addition to the traditional estrogen receptors, there were this other class of receptors called anti-estrogen receptors.
So then looking at a greater range of effects.
And trying to understand how this very tamoxifen is, depending on the tissue and the time, it can either be estrogen-like or it can actually block the effects of estrogen.
Right, which is always a controversy about tamoxifen.
Absolutely.
Yes. Oh, how interesting. So let's talk about the role of environmental toxins and cancer, particularly breast cancer. I think this is well established now, isn't it? I've read things from the National Institute of Health that 90% to 95% of all cancers are the result of toxins from the environment or from our diet.
I wish the world thought things were quite as well established as the way you just spoke. I think there are a couple of issues. One, it depends on how we define the environment. And the environment could be everything except our genes.
Right.
In which case, probably more and more people would say there's a significant to majority of cases that are influenced by environment. Most cancer organizations, when they talk about the environment, they really talk about lifestyle, which is diet, exercise, alcohol, and preclude the discussion of environmental toxicants. So while the Breast Cancer Fund and other environmental health and justice organizations feel absolutely that the evidence is there and are engaging in discussion with many others, most of the traditional cancer organizations don't have those conversations.
Really? Even in this 21st century where there's so much evidence mounting, the traditional organizations still don't buy it, huh?
Absolutely. If you go to the American Cancer Society, you go to Komen, they'll talk about tobacco, exercise, diet, alcohol, and will actually say there are no effects of most other toxicants in the environment.
And I think one of the issues when we look at that, when we ask the question and try to answer it is that, the kind of research you can do to examine whether, a particular chemical, let's say, is linked to breast cancer or a class of chemicals or a group of chemicals that behave a certain way is that the evidence is just really, it's complicated and it's hard to gather. So you can look at animal models, which, certainly we use widely in biomedical and toxicology research. And you can, look at parallel processes and know an amount of knowledge based upon that. And then you can do epidemiological studies, but the epi studies are difficult to do since most of us are, almost everybody's exposed to many of the chemicals in question. So you can't have a control group. You can't do it experimentally and expose some people on purpose. So some of it's about how you read the weight of the evidence.
And some of it, to be honest, is also political and economic. We still don't have definitive evidence. Some would argue that cigarette smoking is linked to lung cancer, although I think after 50 years of working through that, we've gotten most people on board. But the same kind of arguments that it's all correlational, that it's circumstantial, and as Connie just suggested, the weight of the evidence is very hard to pull together. And often when we're talking about this class of chemicals that we call endocrine disruptors, that is chemicals that are found in plasticizers and insecticides and cosmetics, that we're exposed to many, many of them all at one time, the fact that we can't point to any one and say that's the one that caused the cancer means that people who are uncomfortable with the idea of environmental links are empowered to just dismiss the evidence.
Okay. Well, we know there are lots of vested interests in this topic and this discussion.
That's fair.
So I think everyone listening to the show will understand that there are vested interests that do want to argue that, you know, either the evidence is not there or they debate if it even exists as a problem. But I think, you know, you have to be fairly oblivious, or I don't know, some part of your brain's been affected by tamoxifen that you don't really see what is so evident to all of us in our, you know, in our world these days, how toxic it is. And then, of course, your study that we're going to talk about really revealed that. Let's talk a bit about the kinds of exposures that we know increase the risk of breast cancer. What do we know for sure?
Well, I'm going to be careful in the way I frame it and say we believe that there is significant and convincing evidence based on epidemiological studies as supported by hundreds now of both animal and cell culture and other kinds of laboratory studies that, first of all, radiation, including medical radiation, is associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, that exposures to, and it's really important, especially low levels at early developmental times, and I'll come back to that in just a minute, of this class of chemicals we call endocrine disruptors, like bisphenol A that we'll talk about from our study, as well as phthalates and a number of other compounds that are found in very common products, are linked to, as you indicated in your very early comments, perhaps the increase in precocious puberty, but also abnormalities in development of breast tissue that in turn lead to an increased risk for the development of breast cancer. What's particularly important is that the exposures that have been shown to have the greatest effect are very, very early exposures, so we're talking about prenatal, early childhood through adolescence, during the time when breast tissue is maturing. It's a fascinating organ, unlike our heart or our skin or our liver. Breast tissue remains immature through adolescence until a woman actually becomes pregnant and breastfeeds, so it's at a very vulnerable phase throughout the very early stages of life, and that's when it appears that the exposures are having the greatest effects. So we're particularly concerned about radiation and this huge class of chemicals, and we're, again, particularly concerned about these low-level exposures that we're all seeing, and especially early on in life.
You know, Connie, I just want to ask you, as the a person, a program coordinator at the Breast Cancer Fund, are you concerned? Are you seeing in the work that you're doing this growing incidence of breast cancer being found in this younger population? Is that something that you are aware of or have looked at? Or
we have examined the data, and while there's data, if you look at age of diagnosis and race and ethnicity, to suggest some interesting trends and patterns, overall, it doesn't appear that there are actually increasing, or that women are being diagnosed earlier and earlier. Although I think anecdotally, sometimes it feels like that. The data don't as much bear that out as we might have thought. However, you know, younger women, particularly often African American women, when they're diagnosed, are diagnosed with more aggressive tumors, tumors that are that can be characterized often as estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and HER2 negative, which is another hormonal receptor, and those are harder to treat, so they're more aggressive and they do have a less positive prognosis. But the actual, like, younger age diagnosis data is more questionable and doesn't appear to be as strong as I think we would have suspected when we looked at it carefully.
So even though younger women are being diagnosed, what you're saying is that that has always been there, it just hasn't been recognized, or they're just not insignificant numbers in the moment?
So I think it's probably a combination of factors. It's very hard to tease out the observation that more younger women are coming forward, are joining together for support, and so there's a public understanding that breast cancer can be a disease of younger women. In addition, as we factor in, you know, statistically things like later age of childbirth and other factors that may be associated with the changes in breast cancer rates, if we're giving you an honest statistical response, it's that the data right now don't overall show the kind of increase that, that we sort of experientially believe. That being said, along with decreases in the age of puberty and increases in exposures to chemicals and changes in lifestyle and reproductive habits, we are seeing trends that are of the sort, and especially as Connie suggested, in the African American and Latina communities, where probably we may well have evidence soon that these changes are taking place.
Right.
And, you know, and just, you know, our cancer records in this country are abysmal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so to be able, and that's a large part of the problem. It's only been really in the last few years that we've even been keeping record of anybody outside of white and black women. Those are the census classifications. And so to be able to have really the good breakdown, much of it has been for breast cancer under the age of 50, over the age of 50. So the really detailed kinds of statistics that will allow us to answer the question. So we're not trying to say that breast cancer for young women is not an issue. It's a huge, huge issue. If you want a meaningful experience, go to the Young Survivors Conference and be in a room with hundreds of women who've been diagnosed with breast cancer under the age of 35. It is devastating. It is just devastating.
And in my book that I mentioned earlier, What Women Must Know to Protect Their Daughters from Breast Cancer, I actually interviewed five women who are under the age of 30 who were diagnosed. And
yes.
Their stories and what they encountered from not just the diagnosis but the treatment itself.
Absolutely.
You know, had huge consequences.
Absolutely.
So
and the long-term, you know, experiences that they deal with as a result of that treatment. Yeah, certainly a lot of very challenging and powerful stories out there.
Yeah. You know, one last thing I want to ask before we take a break. I just thought I'd throw this in because we've been talking about the environmental connection with breast cancer being an estrogen-sensitive, receptor-sensitive-driven disease. But can we also say that, there are other cancers that can be connected, if not most, to the environment. But what about things like prostate cancer, which also is an estrogen receptor-sensitive cancer? Have you looked at that? Do you have any comments about that relationship for men with prostate cancer and the exposure to those estrogen-like chemicals?
So a lot of the work that we talk about, you actually could take the words breast cancer out and replace with prostate cancer, learning disorder, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, neurodegenerative disorders in general, hormone-sensitive tissues, which actually are
many of the endocrine tissues, obviously, as well as brain and other tissues, are affected by many of these different chemicals. And while when we're talking about breast cancer, mainly about estrogen mimickers or blockers, there are loads of other endocrine disruptors, especially that affect the thyroid, that have in turn effects on prostate and breast and other kinds of tissues also. So this is, the issues we're confronting are not at all limited to breast cancer.
Right. And this is why it's such an important topic, because we're all exposed to these chemicals, and we're going to, when we come back from the break, talk more about the fascinating and important research that you did and the implications of that research. And we all need to pay attention to this. It's really important that we understand what is going on. So we are going to take a short break. I don't want anyone to leave, because this is such an important conversation. We're talking with Connie Engel, who's program director at the Breast Cancer Fund, and Dr. Janet Gray, who's from Vassar, who has authored the Breast Cancer Fund State of the Evidence, the connection between breast cancer and the environment, and a recent study looking at the consequences of bisphenol A and our diet. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and we are having such an enlightening conversation today with Dr. Connie Engel, who is the program coordinator at the Breast Cancer Fund, and Dr. Janet Gray, who's professor of psychology, actually neuroscience, and at Vassar College, and the director of the program in science, technology, and society at Vassar, and also the author of the Breast Cancer Fund's State of the Evidence, the connection between breast cancer and the environment. And I believe, Janet, you were the, are you, correct me if I'm wrong, the lead scientist in the study that looked at the impact of bisphenol A in diet that was published in the Environmental Health Perspectives?
No, actually,
there was a group of us. I'm second author on it, but there are a group of us from both the Breast Cancer Fund and the Silent Spring Institute, and the lead author is Ruth Ann Rudell from the Silent Spring Institute.
Well, thank you for correcting me on that. We want to
okay.
get that straight.
But it was a true collaboration, and all the authors are co-authors.
Oh, that's great. Well, listen, let's first define, when we talk about bisphenol A, for those people listening who may not be familiar with that word and or what it is, let's first define what it is, and then we'll go from there and what that research found.
So consumers might be more familiar with the chemical bisphenol A as its abbreviation BPA. Many people out there have probably gone to buy a water bottle, or if they have young children, maybe baby bottles, and seen BPA-free labels on those containers. So we are starting to see, in that respect, you know, kind of consumer awareness growing as to what this chemical is. So BPA, bisphenol A, they're the same thing. It is a chemical that is used to make polycarbonate plastic. That's plastic that would have, if you look at the bottom of the container, a number 7 recycling code, and it would usually say PC under that recycling code, because 7 stands actually for other. So a little surprising factoid about our recycling codes, not all 7s are BPA. But some 7s are, and those are the ones that are polycarbonate. So it's used in that manufacturing process, and it's also in the lining of food cans, many food cans, as an epoxy resin that protects the food from the metal. So those are two of the common uses that many of us might encounter in our day-to-day lives, and it's also used in a wide array of industrial applications as well.
You
so
know,
it's a chemical that behaves pretty classically as an endocrine disrupting chemical. So it disrupts, it's actually was first synthesized in the 1800s. In the 1930s, it was actually considered as a hormone replacement therapy, as a synthetic estrogen, and later found to not be quite strong enough at mimicking estrogen to be used in a medical setting. So a little bit later, they realized it could be used to make plastics and epoxies, and there we have an estrogen-mimicking chemical used in many applications that we encounter in our day-to-day lives. Over 200 laboratory studies have found associations between the chemical and things like cardiovascular disease, metabolic issues, breast cancer, and prostate cancer, and other reproductive issues. And very few studies have contradicted those findings overall. So that's part of our concern, is this body of evidence really showing some pretty profound health effects, especially like Janet talked about earlier, at early times in animal's development, and especially at low doses.
You know, and again, it's used in so many products. Let me just say, you know, as you were saying, it's found in water bottles that leach into the water from bottles, especially under heat conditions, right?
And yes, absolutely, and magnitudes higher levels with heat application.
And then we have them in the lining of tin cans. And we're going to later on talk about the top foods. And one of the things that shocked me, the things that I like to get in a can, I don't buy many things in a can, but what I really like to buy is coconut milk. I use coconut milk a lot.
Yep.
And I was horrified to learn that that's one of your top foods that is contaminated from the BPA from cans, in the lining of cans.
Yeah, you aren't alone in that. So when we looked at that, we looked at the body of literature that's examined the leaching of BPA into foods from the food cans. And there were about 300 different individual product tests from a number of different studies that we consolidated. And coconut milk was indeed the highest, although it was a set of 3 samples, actually, so smaller number than many other cases, but consistently high across all 3 of those.
Wow.
So fattier foods, saltier foods seem to be the kinds of things that seem to absorb it more readily.
And the other thing that I have to say probably horrifies me most of all, although all of it's on a scale of being horrified, but and that's the use of dental sealants, which contains BPA. And it's put on the teeth of young children. And it also leaches BPA, and that's that vulnerable population, Janet, you were talking about, that's so at risk from exposure. And here we are using it in our dental sealants, which we think is, we think it's a good thing helping our kids, but little do parents know it's leaching right into their bloodstream.
One of the other products is thermal cash register receipts, and a recent study looking at body burden of bisphenol A, BPA, and we know that BPA is found extensively in the bodies of Americans. The CDC found over 93% of adults have BPA in their bodies, and similar studies have shown, shown similar results in young children, infants, in umbilical cord, placenta, and this particular study was looking at body burden in pregnant women, and the highest concentrations were in women who were ran cash registers. And so this is not only getting into adults, but clearly into pregnant women, and therefore very concerned that getting exposures to their fetuses.
Isn't that amazing? We don't think about that. So just hand it, it's in the paper or is it in the ink? The bisphenol?
It's a dust product that's put on the paper as a layer with invisible ink on top of it. And then the process of printing is a thermal process which turns the invisible ink into visible ink through an interaction with the BPA.
Gosh. Oh, my gosh. So Janet, let's talk about your study. And why don't you just take us through what the intention of the study was and how it was conducted and what you found.
Sure. I'm actually going to let Connie do it because she was the main person who actually ran the day-to-day.
Oh.
She was our field coordinator, so I think she should be the one who...
Absolutely. Connie, over to you.
All right. We started out with this question, wondering, basically, if we took BPA out of people's diets, would we see a genuine drop in the levels of BPA in their bodies? And that was our starting point, and we designed the study around that. So we recruited five families in the Bay Area, because that's where the Breast Cancer Fund is located. That's where our headquarters are. And those families were all families of four, with two parents living at home and two kids old enough to be potty trained, but only up to age 12. And we interviewed them about their food intake before the study, selected families who had at least some hint that they were likely to be consuming foods and beverages that could have had BPA that leached from the containers they used, et cetera. So they were drinking from water bottles or eating canned foods or eating a lot of meals outside the home, for instance. And then we had them eat their normal diets. And we took two measures of we took their urine. They gave us their urine, I guess, on two occasions while they were eating their normal food. And then we brought them 3 days' worth of catered foods. And we worked with this phenomenal organic caterer who already was using glass containers in her food delivery. She was kind of a personal chef to multiple people, and so she would deliver families food in glass containers, so she was perfect. And she prepared these 3 days' worth of foods for our five families, put them in glass containers, and we delivered those to them. They ate those foods, and we, again, collected urine, and then they went back to their normal diets, and again, we collected urine, and we looked at their levels across the three different time points, eating what they normally ate, eating the food that we brought to them in glass, and going back to their normal diets, and we saw a 66% drop in BPA levels when they were eating the food we delivered, and those levels went right back up when they started eating their normal foods again.
So one of the things that's really important as we planned the study, and that was supported by our data,
is that unlike many chemicals that we worry about, BPA is actually cleared out of our bodies very, very quickly. So this is good news. In this study, we were able, by making some fairly simple changes in what people ate. So they weren't; these were not people eating nothing but salad. They were eating balanced foods. They were drinking water out of stainless steel, eating food that had been packaged in glass. But basically, lasagna and chicken and
cinnamon rolls. Oh, the cinnamon rolls were very popular.
By making these few very basic changes in eliminating standard food packaging and really attending to the sources of the food, in just 3 days' time, we were able to decrease people's average BPA levels by 65%.
Did that surprise you, that in just 3 days of eating clean food from clean sources, you could see such a radical drop?
We were not surprised that we saw a drop, and like Janet said, we designed the study knowing that BPA stays in the body, about half of it leaves every 6 hours. So we thought the three-day range was reasonable, but we were surprised by the magnitude that it was, 66%, not 28%, let's say. I mean, we were really, really impressed by the degree of the decline.
When we started out, we chose a fairly small number of people for a study of this sort. So there were only 10 adults and 10 children, and we really viewed it as pretty much a pilot study. That is, let's see if the methodology is workable and what we can get from this to maybe then have to go out and do a much larger study. That we got data that were not only just profoundly obvious to the eye, but statistically significant with so few people in such a short time, that surprised us.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty shocking when I read the results of that study. What are the consequences of that study? Did it get lots of media attention? Are you getting the ear of people in positions of policy change? Any of the consequences you're aware of at this point?
It certainly got a lot of media coverage. I think we had over 100 television spots. We had provided some video footage, so it was easy for local stations to cover it. So many of those were local, but it was on Diane Sawyer's ABC News Tonight, which was, pretty incredible. Front page story on the San Francisco Chronicle, so that was super. And a big motivation actually for doing the study was looking at some bills that were coming out in the federal government as well as state governments. I think this year there are about almost 20 bills in different states looking at banning BPA at least from some products, and we were motivated to ask the question, actually, partly to, say if these bills were passed, this would have a meaningful impact on the levels of BPA in people's bodies.
Right.
This would have a broad effect very rapidly on a lot of people. And, that this study bore that out does give an added bit of leverage to call for reform of food packaging and push forward legislation that could make a difference for a lot of folks.
So right now there is a legislative initiative at both the federal and, as Connie just said, many state levels. It has not been nearly as successful at the federal level as it has at the state level, where many states we have seen BPA bans from children and infants, bottles, sippy cups, sometimes actually the formula inside of them, but passed bipartisanly, signed by Republican governors, signed by Democratic governors, with almost unanimous support, sometimes unanimous support. There has been a lot of economic support for trying to make sure these bills don't pass, and so we, as Connie suggested, we were really motivated to try to show that with simple changes you can affect chains that may have important health effects, and we'll be using it in our policy initiatives and advocacy over the next year as we try to be successful in the states that are considering these banned BPA bills now.
Right. Well, I think your study really made that point very well, that just a little shift, just changing the diet in just 3 days can have a huge ramification on your toxic load. Can we talk about the top 10 canned foods that can reduce people's BPA exposure by just eliminating these foods? What were, I know you tested more than 300 products and you have a top list of 10 foods. Remember that bisphenol A is found in the lining of tin cans. So what are the foods we need to, really avoid totally?
Well, so let me say first that what we did was actually look at the literature that had tested for BPA in canned foods and in other kinds of products as well. So we looked at studies that had been published in academic journals, studies that had been done by other organizations, and even studies that were done by the FDA and Health Canada, and that's where the data points came from. We did some product testing ourselves to fill in some gaps, especially looking at BPA levels in alternatives or non-canned foods, but most of those data came from a range of very reputable sources, and so collectively, those different studies had looked at 300 canned food, over 300 canned food items, and some of the key ones to avoid, I won't go through the top 10, but coconut milk was the highest level, although, again, like I said earlier, there were three data points, so that's a qualification. Be great to see more testing of that, to feel more confident in that, but also soups. Meals like anything that's like some of the pasta meals with meatballs and stuff like that had high levels. Vegetables had surprisingly high levels, which is a very obvious concern because you think you're doing the right thing by your family by giving them something, healthy on the plate, and it contains these high levels of BPA. So those were some of the biggest concerns.
And of course, this is a particular concern from more of an environmental justice perspective, as with the economy being not so good, more and more people have turned to canned vegetables, often nice as it would be if we could all eat fresh, organic, local vegetables. Sometimes they're hard to find, and sometimes they're just more expensive, and people are turning more to canned vegetables. And so the very people we may be most concerned about, who are also buying their products in dollar stores, and I don't want to overly simplify, but are not being protected through even legislative acts right now. So it's really important. This isn't something that we can just buy our way out. We really need to get these chemicals out of the products more systemically.
And, can we say that everybody has this chemical in their bodies at this point in time?
Well, the CDC showed, I think it was 93.8%, so I can't say everybody, but it's quite pervasive and by far the majority of people. So over 90%, whether you're looking at adults, children, infants, cord blood, placenta.
Right. So that's the bad news. And the good news is that what your study showed, that just 3 days of eating BPA-free food, from containers, glass containers, stainless steel, and organic food, saw up to 66% drop in bisphenol A levels. Mm-hmm. That's just 3 days. So that's the good news. Our body has the capacity to detoxify itself from those chemicals. One thing I want to say is that we've talked about the important research linking these environmental chemicals like bisphenol A to hormone disruption that affects men and women. And the other thing I just want to mention briefly, because I really want you, Connie, to give more details about the Breast Cancer Fund, but it also seems to be playing a role with the obesity epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, do either one of you just want to mention something briefly about that connection? Because I, that's another area that I've really been concerned with and writing and researching and looking at the missing pieces that are contributing to this obesity epidemic, and it seems that bisphenol A could be one of them.
Yes, yeah, so there, one of the early, this is a human clinical study, indicates that a link between bisphenol A levels in adults and insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, other metabolic disorders, and that's all supported by extensive and actually growing animal data. So not surprisingly, given the ways in which hormones work on many systems, and we know that estrogens are very important in especially fat metabolism, that there is growing data linking endocrine disruptors in general, whether they affect thyroid, estrogen, whatever, with diabetes and with, again, insulin resistance and metabolic function.
Yeah. Right, I think that's really important that people understand. It has many consequences to our health and to the many health challenges we are facing as a society. Connie, let's just take a moment, and can you give a little more information about the Breast Cancer Fund and how, you know, your website, how people can learn more about what you're doing and participate?
Absolutely. So our mission really is focusing on identifying the environmental links to breast cancer and then advocating for their elimination. So we do a lot of work to educate people, to push for policies that really make common sense and protect public health. And we consider ourselves to be science-based, so we really look carefully at the scientific evidence and use that to guide our direction. We have a really fantastic website that has these great flash pieces where you can kind of click on a person and learn more about an issue, or click on an item and learn more about an issue, and people can find that at www.breastcancerfund.org. And if they look on there, they can learn about the science, they can find ways to take action, and send messages to companies, to legislators, et cetera, and ways to get involved with the work that we do. We also just very soon have coming up our annual Climb Against the Odds, which is one of our major fundraising initiatives, and people can on our page just do a search for Climb Against the Odds and even pick someone to sponsor someone who's climbing to the top of a 14,000-foot mountain to raise money for us.
Well, that's so exciting. You know, I've been a member of your site for many, many, many years now, and it's one of those places I go to get really good, honest information about what is happening in the world of environmental toxins and breast cancer. And you're just doing great work, and I just so thank you and very grateful for your commitment to a very
important
issue.
Thank you so much.
And Janet, what about your website, and what are some of the resources that you want people to know about?
Well, you know, I started doing work with my master students on the ERBC Environmental Risks and Breast Cancer website before I became actively involved with the Breast Cancer Fund. So this was my first foray into this kind of work, and it really covers a lot of similar materials. I think the Breast Cancer Fund's website is just much more comprehensive, kept up to date. There's a professional team keeping it up to date daily, whereas I get to do it every few months. But I think the two features that really the VASTR site have that, and the two sites really articulate with one another, is first of all that our site is bilingual, so it is in both English and Spanish, and the students especially cared very deeply that we would from the get-go be reaching out to the Latina community. And then secondly, again, by students, there is a series of six absolutely phenomenal animations that deal with issues from very basic statistics about breast cancer to, much more importantly, the anatomy and physiology of the breast.
Janet, we're at the end. Give us the website.
erbc.vassar.edu. Sorry.
Okay. Fabulous. I wish we had more time, and we will have to get you both back Thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Well, what a fantastic show. We were talking to Dr. Connie Engel and Dr. Janet Gray, who were involved with the groundbreaking study showing how bisphenol A can be removed from the body by just 3 days of eating clean food, 66% reduction of this hormone-disrupting chemical. Thank you all for listening. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and reminding you to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.